Dame Sarah Mullally is an historic choice as the new Archbishop of Canterbury, but how will she deal with the chasm that has opened in the worldwide Anglican Church? Its 85 million followers are split over sexuality and gender, but is there also lingering opposition to women priests? Australian Andrew McGowan is Dean of the Berkeley School of Divinity at Yale University and a former editor of the Journal of Anglican Affairs. He's also an Anglican priest, so just a click or two away from being eligible for the job himself. Would he have wanted it?
Oh, so many reasons to say no to that, not all of which are for the air, but I think anyone sensible would probably not have wanted it. And I even gathered from some conversations that people have reported about Sarah Mullally that she didn't really want it that much either, at least at one point. I tend to think that someone who is eager to accept the role of bishop is probably disqualifying themselves by doing so.
Why would you say no, though? Because there was a sting in the tail of that question, because it goes to what she now faces. Why would you say no?
Anyone accepting this job is accepting an extremely burdensome position, a very important one, of course, but one which has many of the qualities that those listening who've had significant roles of leadership will understand, the way she'll become a sort of proxy for all kinds of fears and fantasies. It's coming at a difficult time in the life, both of the Church of England and of the Anglican Communion.
Yeah. What's the biggest fracture line that runs through the worldwide Anglican Church, in your view?
Perhaps the most obvious answer has to do with the position of LGBTQ people, and then more concretely, the question of same-sex marriages or blessings and of ordination of such persons in various churches. That's perhaps that which attracts the greatest amount of attention and is the most deeply controversial. But I think that her appointment has reminded us that the question of women's ordination and leadership has not really gone away either in the minds of many. And so we find in some of the commentary that's going on from those who are critical of the appointment a bit of zigzagging between whether the real issue is the fact that Sarah Mullally is a woman or whether they feel that she has not taken a sound enough line from a conservative perspective on questions of how inclusion of same-sex attracted people ought to work.
My reading suggests that conservative or orthodox Anglicans are probably more likely to reconcile themselves to her as a woman leader than they are to what they perceive as her liberalism on sex and sexuality. I noticed that even the conservative grouping in the Global South has some women bishops as part of those churches. It seems to me that it's sexuality rather than sex.
There's an element of truth in that, but we've also seen in this past week those two issues sort of seem to keep changing places in the minds of some people. You're quite right to point out that, in fact, among the churches that are referred to loosely as Global South or GAFCON aligned, a number of them already have women bishops. So the church in South Sudan, for instance, the church in Kenya, the church in South Africa, the church of Mozambique and Angola all have women who are bishops, and therefore the issue is much more up in the air there. However, the leaders of the GAFCON movement have been trying to use the relative unanimity, a negative unanimity, of course, about same-sex marriage and so forth, as a means with which to hold people back on the question of women's ordination. What we've actually got there are two overlapping sets of concerns, and there's now a struggle going on within that block about whether and how women's ordination might be something on which they can agree to differ, or whether, as the more hardline conservative people want to do, to use the opposition to same-sex marriage and the ordination of same-sex attracted people as a bat with which to sort of beat up the question of women's ordination and to hold the line on that as well. So there are fissures there. And when the GAFCON movement issued within 30 seconds its statement of mourning, so-called, on Sarah Mullally's appointment, and the fact that it came so quickly, of course, needs to be thought about quite carefully as far as whether it was a deep, reflective and sincere statement. I'll leave people to draw their conclusions. But there was an attempt there to sort of say, well, this is all really about the fact that she hasn't taken a clear enough line about same-sex blessings in the Church of England. But then within a few days, the Church of Nigeria, which is one of the most hardline of the African churches, said that it would break off all connections and ties with the See of Canterbury, which it had effectively done already, but which somehow it saw fit to make a bigger deal of this week after Sarah Mullally's appointment. And I don't think that her position on same-sex unions and so forth is markedly more progressive or radical than that of her predecessor. What's the difference? She's a woman.
Mm. You've always tried to see different perspectives in the Anglican Communion. It seems to me, Andrew, that the worldwide church is being torn from both ends because, yes, we mentioned the church in Africa, which is where about 60% of Anglicans now live, and the Sydney Anglican Diocese sort of cheers them on. But the Episcopal Church in the United States, does it help with its pretty hardline liberalism these days?
It's a good question. I would say that while I'm broadly sympathetic to the positions that the Episcopal Church represents around those questions, that there is sometimes a lack of self-awareness about what it means for a predominantly white liberal denomination to take the positions that it does without really having the depth of relationship with some of those other national churches that could really help them to understand what the impact of those are. People here are very aware of the impact upon LGBTQ people and are primarily interested in protecting and being in solidarity with them. And I don't think that in itself is wrong, but I do think that there is a lack of awareness of how attention to the relationships with those Anglicans in other places whose experience and beliefs do not align with that could actually still be something important and from which they should learn.
Yes, I notice, for example, that the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church in the United States, Sean Rowe, went out of his way to praise Sarah Mullally for supporting same-sex civil relationships, the very thing that he surely knew would inflame other parts, other very large parts of the Anglican Church.
Yes, but I suspect that perhaps as you were hinting at a moment ago, the Episcopal Church's place in this exercise is so far gone as far as, say, the likes of Nigeria is concerned, that Nigeria is not interested in what the Episcopal Church here thinks. And so Bishop Sean's words, I suspect, are more for his own audience than for a global one. But perhaps he's also hoping to encourage her because amid all these Anglican Communion politics, we have to bear in mind that the Church of England itself, as a national church, is in a very tough position at the moment with deeply entrenched positions and figures and factions on both sides of this question of same-sex blessings and so forth. And its own capacity to work this through in terms of its own mission and its own constituency, and not just in terms of whether Nigerians or Americans are making loud noises on either side of them, we have to sort of give them the support they need to work their way through this issue and hopefully emerge with some measure of integrity as well as some form of unity.
Is liberalism, though, working for the Anglican Church around the world? Just take the Episcopal Church in the United States. It was once the Church of Presidents and Chief Justices. I think it's now down to less than 1% of the population. I think it struggles to get 900,000 people around the entire country to church on any Sunday. Is liberalism working for the church, especially when we read of the sort of quiet revival? It seems to me that people who are seeking certainty in a world of swirling uncertainty may think twice about going to what they consider to be another fount of relativism.
The short answer is that it is and it isn't, and a lot depends on where you look. The quiet revival, as you refer to it, is taking place within the Episcopal Church as well. And, I mean, I'm the head of an Episcopal seminary within Yale that has 60 or so full-time students who are younger than the population of any Australian theological college, who are all deeply committed to the liturgy of the Book of Common Prayer, who are all seeking to grow as Christian disciples. There's a younger generation in this country that doesn't really conform to neat stereotypes about liberalism or conservatism. They tend, in fact, by many standards, to be somewhat liturgically and even theologically conservative, but they're not convinced that the tradition of the church or the teaching of the Bible require them to be exclusive of gay and lesbian people or require them to exclude women from leadership. on the side of decline, let's not try and gild the lily. The Episcopal Church is in a state of freefall still, but not because it's the Episcopal Church. If you look at mainline Protestantism generally in the United States, it's all in freefall. And in fact, the Episcopal Church is doing quite a bit better than some of the denominations that were also rather grand and glorious 50 or 100 years ago, Presbyterians and Congregationalists, for instance. But this is familiar to Australians as well. We've all been in a situation where there are a couple of lost generations now, when sometime, I think in the 60s in Australia and in the 80s in this country, younger people decided all of a sudden that church going and religious practice were not necessarily an assumed part of their participation in the social order. And the churches haven't really worked out what to do about that yet. On the one hand, there are non-denominational groups with their bands and their screens who are pulling some people in. It's also true, now, as you gathered from me, that there are more traditional liturgical communities that are drawing some people in. But it's going to take a long time to work out whether a quiet revival can really offset 50 or so years of pretty deep secularization. But that's not a specifically Episcopal Church problem.
Yes, I know. I guess the point is, though, that all of the churches that you've mentioned, the mainline churches in the United States, from about the 80s, but particularly in the last 25 years, they've really accelerated their liberalism on questions of sex and sexuality. I mean, the Catholics would argue, yes, our quiet revival with young people is coming with people who subscribe to very orthodox Christian views. They want certainty. I guess I wonder if the middle has dropped out of Anglicanism, the ability to stay together but also eschew absolutes, whether it be absolute liberalism or absolute literalism.
There may be some truth in that. I think that what's happening on the ground is more like two stories than one. A sort of liberalism which is not actually interested, for instance, in Christian doctrine as such, you know, thinks that the Bible shouldn't be taken too seriously, thinks that, you know, worship is just traditional expression of individual spirituality. That stuff is falling apart very quickly. But I think that we actually have to parse liberalism a little more carefully here. It's true, of course, that some Roman Catholic and, for that matter, Eastern Orthodox versions of the quiet revival may include very traditional or even hyper-traditional moral positions, along with the rest of their interest in things like liturgy and spirituality. But I can point to many places on the ground here where, again, the Episcopal Church and some others are finding that young people do want that sense of mystery. They do think that they want to take the Bible seriously. So they're not actually classic liberals in the sense that people may assume, but they do not think that the questions of gender and sexuality are the measure of orthodoxy. And that's why I, for instance, will always balk at the use of the term orthodox as a way to refer to those who hold to traditional or hyper-traditional teachings about those particular issues, when in fact, I think the people who are creating growth, people who are providing signs of hope for the church on the ground, are indeed people who don't conform to a standard liberal kind of paradigm, because they think the Bible and the tradition of the church is important, but they don't think that gender and sexuality are the touchstones for whether or not that's the case.
I just end, though, with a recollection. It's 3 years ago when I was last in the United States. I was there, having lived there for 4 years in the mid to late 90s. I attended an Episcopal church, a very well-known Episcopal church on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Afterwards, I did ask the priest what happened to the creed and to the confession. And she said, well, we don't want to get too hung up on the guilt stuff, do we? And I kind of thought, that's sort of half the deal, isn't it? You know, guilt, yeah. Repentance, it's kind of half the deal. But I did wonder about the rigor.
Oh, absolutely. And I think I know even the place you're talking about. I was in New York City yesterday. I went to a church in Midtown, which had a large enough congregation that any Australian parish I can think of would be pretty happy with it, where the liturgy was said using the traditional Tudor language, where the priest faced east, where there was incense, bells, and a choir singing the propers in Latin, where the congregation was young and ethnically diverse. There was a confession and there was a creed. And I think these are sort of the two realities that are running along in the Episcopal Church at the moment. To be honest, many of us think that sort of stuff where we're not really that worried about Jesus or about penitence is a sort of dying boomer paradigm. But there is another paradigm that's on the ascendant now. It's interested in tradition. It's interested in liturgy. It is interested in the notion of penitence and renewal and the notion of Christian discipleship. But its shibboleths are not quite those of attributed to conservative Christianity. We will see as this quiet revival bubbles along exactly what seems to be essential to it and what really doesn't. And that's going to vary from place to place.
Andrew McGowan from the Berklee School of Divinity at Yale University. There's a longer version of that chat when you go to our website or follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.